poet, essayist, and fiction writer Anthony Grooms often grapples with difficult issues of race and relationships in his work, but it's tempered with empathy and humor. His early award-winning short story collection, Trouble No More, reveals the lives of middle-class Black Americans from across the South and the effects of the Civil Rights Movement. His dramatic first novel, Bombingham, looks at the turbulent 1960s and the Vietnam War from the vantage point of characters from Birmingham, Alabama. Now his novel, The Vain Conversation, based on an actual 1946 lynching in rural Georgia, gives insight into the complicated human relationships of characters, Black and white, in the Jim Crow South.
As violent as lynching is, of course, there are other kinds of violence that has happened in the history in the South.
That too is revealed in Anthony Groom's compelling novel, The Vain Conversation, named a 2019 Honor Book for Fiction by the Black Caucus of the American Library Association, and also a finalist for the 2020 Townsend Prize for Fiction. Stay with us for readings from the book at the Kansas City Public Library, with a conversation between Tony Grooms and fellow novelist Whitney Terrell, here on New Letters on the Air, a production of New Letters Magazine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. I'm Angela Elam. The son of a seamstress and a refrigeration mechanic with the University of Virginia Hospital, Anthony Grooms was a first-generation college student. He received degrees from William & Mary and then George Mason University before moving to Georgia, where he's taught writing at Kennesaw State University since 1994. I interviewed him for New Letters on the Air about his first novel, Bombingham, when he came to Kansas City for the Writers at Work series with novelist Whitney Terrell, who brought him back in 2019 to speak on writing on race at the Kansas City Public Library with another writer, Damaris Hill. We'll hear her half of the interview in an upcoming show. Here's Whitney Terrell, who now teaches in the MFA Creative Writing Program at UMKC.
Anthony Grooms was one of the very first people to read in the Writers at Work series. I feel like back in 2001, maybe it was, for his novel Bombingham, when the series was based at Rockhurst University. Was it 2000? Am I wrong about when Bombingham was published?
Bombingham was published in 2001.
Yeah.
I think I came the year after.
Yeah, 2002. Yeah.
But, you know.
You still look good.
In this century, yeah. Yeah, I've been preserving myself. I'm reminded while I'm sitting here with Whit that the last time I was with you in Kansas City, you introduced me to Jeff Loeb.
Yeah.
And because we were talking about American deserters in Sweden.
Right.
And so that was actually the beginning of the novel that's now circulating.
Oh, really? Oh, that's fantastic. Well, he's going to be talking about The Vain Conversation, which is an amazing, amazing book set in Georgia. And it's around the events of a lynching in 1946, told from both the points of view of Black and white characters in the novel. And it's some sort of amazing meditation on the way violence webs its way out into a community. So I wondered if you could maybe just start off by introducing your book to the audience here.
The Vain Conversation began about 27 years ago when I read in the Atlanta Journal about a man named Clinton Adams, who as a 10-year-old had witnessed what we call the Moores Ford lynchings, the lynchings of two Black couples near Monroe, Georgia. These murders were never solved, even though there had been a couple of grand jury inquiries. I was really interested in Clinton Adams because he was a witness and because he said that for all of that time, this was sometime in the early 90s or so, that all that time he had been running, he had been unsettled, he did not have a voice because he'd been silenced in his community. So it was Adams that attracted me to the story more so than lynchings, because unfortunately lynchings are fairly common in our history. So I began to write, and then I wrote some other things, and I met Whit, and then eventually this book was published.
So Lonnie is that character then in the corollary?
Yeah, Lonnie is a character that is inspired by Clinton Adams.
Okay.
Although this is not a history of Clinton Adams by a long shot.
Right, right.
Adams has been in the, at least in the Atlanta paper, relatively recently because of events around the Morris Mills lynching. First, the FBI and the GBI haven't reopened the case when he first talked about having witnessed the murders, investigated for some years, and now closed the cases, both agencies did, saying that the participants are dead and they couldn't make any progress with the investigation. But just this week, an appeals panel of the district court, federal court, has allowed the grand jury proceedings, the federal grand jury's proceedings, those documents, to be made public against the wishes of our former attorney general. We'll see what happens if we get to name names.
That's kind of amazing.
It is, actually.
There's a lot of imagery of entrapment and confinement also in the Vane conversation. And in the opening scene, this young white character, Lonnie, whose point of view you're running from, witnesses this lynching, as you were just talking about. And at the end of the scene, he ends up in this web of kudzu vines, caught like an insect in a web, is what you write. And you return to this image toward the end of the book when Lonnie appears. Can you talk about why you were using that image for him?
Well, the image isn't so much for him. Do you all know what kudzu is? I just want to be sure, yeah. You have to go down south. It's something that doesn't do well in snow, but it is an Asian bean, essentially, that was imported by the Agricultural Department of the state of Alabama back in the 19th century to control erosion. It does control erosion and everything else. When you drive along roads in Georgia and South Carolina and Alabama, farm roads, sometimes you will see structures that have this vine that has just overwhelmed them, and these odd toporaries along the roadside because of this vine. There's a joke in Atlanta that when you get a new neighbor who is from the Northeast in particular, who sees the vine, because it is a pretty vine, will say, "Oh, I want to grow some of that on my fence." And then you have to shoot that neighbor because it is extraordinarily invasive. It grows a foot a day in the summertime, and it has roots that long. So it's very difficult to eradicate, even though they're working actually on insects that might eradicate it. But these are tangly vines, and the book begins with blackberry vines, which are also tangly, and the fruit of the blackberry is enticing and sweet. And actually, if you get close to kudzu when it's blooming, there is a very small pea-like purple bloom that smells like grape Kool-Aid, which is, you know, kind of a nice thing about it, but the leaves are big and pretty. But it is also something that you just don't want to get into. And this is a metaphor for race relations in the South and the culture of the South, that we're all entangled in our histories, we're all entangled in what we do, and we just don't get out of it that easily. It's very similar to the tar baby image in Uncle Remus, where you play with the tar baby, you get tar on you.
You're listening to novelist Anthony Grooms on New Letters on the Air. By the way, those documents on the federal grand jury's proceedings about the real-life lynchings that inspired the Vane conversation have been held up again by the Justice Department. The fictional story by Grooms begins with Lonnie, the 10-year-old white sharecropper's son, who's waiting for his father, Wayne, to return from World War II. When the traumatized father comes home, he bonds with a fellow soldier, the African-American teacher Bertrand. Both crave cultural change, but in that small Georgia town, such friendships across racial lines were taboo. Then Bertrand's pregnant niece is defended from the abusive white man Venable by Jimmy Lee, and deadly repercussions ensue. Again, here's Whitney Terrell.
There's a moment in the Vane conversation where there's a black character who attacks a white landowner, right? And Bertrand is trying to protect him, and he says, "We should go for justice. We should appeal," you know, because Bertrand is a veteran. He's just fought in World War II and says, "This is what we fought for." And that's the turning point of the book. And I thought maybe we could talk about that appeal for justice as opposed to mob violence, right? And why that's so important in your narrative.
In my book, it's a bit ambiguous because
it's a bad idea.
Yeah, it was a very bad idea as it turned out. But what's also happening is that you're getting an argument, a debate between Bertrand and his wife. Bertrand has come to a point where he is desperately ideal. He has been in the European theater of World War II. He's seen the extermination camps. And he's saying that this can't be America. And he's made that commitment, so he's now going to put into practice those ideals that he feels that America should live up to, even though it takes more than one person to put those ideals into practice.
Right.
His wife, on the other hand, having survived trauma of her own, doesn't buy into that. So they are caught in this argument about how to advise Jimmy Lee, the character who has, fighting for the honor of his girlfriend, stabbed the prominent white landowner.
Venable, who's such a nasty character, but written very well. And, you know, unfortunately, bad characters are interesting.
Yeah, you know, I don't see him as nasty. I just see him as misguided.
Oh. Well, you and I will have a conversation about that later.
But that's the way I have to see him. If I thought of him as nasty, it would be a different novel. You have to really try to understand characters as people, quote unquote, as artificial people, people you make up. And you try, at least I try as a narrator, not to judge them too harshly, but rather let them judge themselves or their actions be judged by the readers. So Bertrand wants to trust the system, and he advises Jimmy Lee to give himself up to the police. Llewellyn says, no, run. So that's the dilemma that they find themselves in.
There's a very powerful section in the middle of the book, Tony, where you describe a scrapbook that Llewellyn, Bertrand's wife, as on her side of the argument, right, which is realism, real politic, right, keeps what she calls her true book of American history. I wondered if you could read that passage.
So the setting is the bedroom of Llewellyn and Bertrand's house. This is after the conversation that we've just talked about, the debate about whether or not Jimmy Lee should run. This is from Bertrand's perspective as he observes Llewellyn. Slowly, Llewellyn turned a page of her scrapbook. The sound of the page turning indicated that the paper was heavy and soft. Bertrand had seen the book many times. She called it her true book of American history. She had been a history major when he met her, and she had said that she was collecting information for her own history of the United States. No happy slaves doing master's biddings would be in her book. No mammies wet nursing mistress's children. Enough of that, she said, this would be a book of the naked nature of America, as beastly as it was foul. But Llewellyn, he would occasionally argue, all white people aren't bad, and even if they were, you can't think that way. For one thing, it's not Christian, and for another, it will eat you up. Hating eats you up just as badly as being hated. She often dismissed him with a wave of her hand or countered that hate hadn't eaten up the whites. They seemed to be doing mighty well hating. He glimpsed the page, a picture of men hanging from a tree branch. She was studying the picture. It seemed rereading the caption for how many times he couldn't imagine. The article was from the Chicago Defender about a lynching in southern Indiana nearly 20 years before. Two boys, just teenagers, had been accused of raping a white woman and murdering her boyfriend. Without a trial, they were taken from their cells by a crowd, were beaten and hanged. Bertrand knew that reading the scrapbook just before bedtime, Llewellyn wouldn't sleep. The more she read, the more upset she would become, but he could do nothing about it. Llewellyn, honey, come on to bed now. Let it go. She looked more closely at the photograph as if counting the details. Bertrand knew she was going inside of it, removing herself from the bedroom and drawing herself into the frame of the picture with all of its anxiety and tension. She would be one in the crowd, perhaps even the photographer, examining the bodies of the boys that swung from the tree like scarecrows, limp and tattered. In her mind, she ran her hands over their bloodied heads, their necks cocked at odd angles. She looked into their dull eyes, oddly peaceful and already drying out. She was already becoming an unseen guest among the onlookers, a part of the crowd of whites, men, women, children. There was a couple holding lovingly to each other as if they were on a date at the fair. The people wore ordinary clothes, casual suits, open-collared shirts, straw hats and calico dresses. She saw no hoods or sheets, no monstrous costumes with flaming crosses. These were typical townspeople of a typical town. She might have seen one of them just last night at the county fair, or she might see them tomorrow strolling along Bethany's main street. They were townspeople in typical postures who would have been at any typical gathering of such people. They had not turned into monsters, neither had their veins emptied of blood and filled with gasoline. They could have been witnessing anything, a freak show, a wedding, or pig roast. That it was a lynching wasn't so uncommon, she would have thought. She had told him that the Romans flocked to see men chop each other up with swords. In England, people jostled one another to watch beheadings and drawings and quarterings, spectacles, to watch someone's intestines being drawn from his body and his body being sawn into quarters. What must go through people's minds to watch such things? She couldn't do it, she said. She could never do it. And yet, something in her said she could kill those whites in the picture if she had to. But that would be different. She would kill them, but it would not be a spectacle.
Anthony Grooms reading from his novel, The Vain Conversation. The title comes from the first epistle of Peter, 1:18. For as much as ye know that ye were not redeemed with corruptible things, as silver or gold from your vain conversation received by tradition from your fathers. The novel also reveals the viewpoint of the white character, Nolan Jax, Venable's friend, who was implicated in the lynchings of Bertrand and his wife Llewellyn, their niece Bee, and her boyfriend Jimmy Lee. Anthony Grooms talks about the influence of some of his own family history on his writing here on New Letters on the Air.
As violent as lynching is, of course, there are other kinds of violence that has happened in the history in the South. I grew up in Virginia, which we might recall during the early parts of the Civil Rights Movement closed several of its counties and cities, including the city of Charlottesville, where I was born, but it happened before my birth, closed down its school system in order to prevent integration. I was a part of a program called Freedom of Choice when my county, not very freely, I should say, I chose to maintain two separate systems, but created the idea that parents could place their children in either the formerly all-black system or the formerly all-white system. Wink, wink. Well, of course, my parents said, okay, we'll take you up on that. We only have, you know, these couple of kids to sacrifice anyway. People say, oh, you were a civil rights hero. No, my daddy did it. And you know what he said? Sticks and stones might break your bones, but words will never hurt you. You're going to the white school. But they did it because they wanted us to get a good education, and so we did that. When the schools finally did, under federal mandate, integrate, black principals, black school teachers lost their jobs. Certain black school teachers were allowed to maintain, these were the super teachers, were allowed to maintain their jobs, but many of them lost their jobs. And even more profoundly, the black schools were renamed. I come from a very American colonial place, and we were told that you couldn't have a school named for anyone who didn't come from the 1700s. So Thomas Jefferson, Patrick Henry, you could have
that schools. That sort of
named.
Seems to limit the options there a little bit.
Yeah. But interestingly enough, John Mercer Langston came from our county, and so even though he's 19th century, he hasn't gotten a school name for him, but he did get a plaque. So in those ways, black history was lost. In fact, if you Google the elementary school that was the black high school at that time, the time that I was young, it will not give you any of the history of the time that it was black. But worse than that, when I look at how my parents were educated or not educated, in rural Virginia, then I have an understanding of how the system brutalized them. My father's 92. He's still very witty. Don't get in a debate with him. He will say something that will embarrass you, and it will be true. But nonetheless, there weren't any opportunities for them, and what opportunities there were always cut off in some way to preserve in the county I grew up in was to preserve farm labor. And we see this in, you know, Slavery by Another Name, for example, the same kind of story. I think the dynamics of class and race oppression have changed a little bit. We don't need the workers so much, but we do need the oppression, apparently.
Well, the workers are now undocumented immigrants. I mean, that's sort of where the argument has shifted in some ways, mm-hmm. I think, if you want to look at it economically.
Mm-hmm. And I do think there's a strong economic part of this story.
I love that in your novel. Like, Venables immediately goes and says, like, hey, do you want to come back and work at the farm, mm-hmm. you know? And he says that to Wayne, also, who's white, who's coming mm-hmm. back to share a crop, right?
Because one of the biggest mistakes poor white people have made is that they have chosen to align themselves with other white people rather than aligning themselves with other poor people. And thus, they don't align themselves necessarily with people with their own set of problems or goals.
There's a great James Baldwin quote that has something to do about, like, if poor whites and blacks could ever, like, make common cause, that would be the greatest thing that could ever happen, but it will take forever for it to happen.
It has happened in the past. We had something called the Southern Farmers Tenants Union, and of course, what happened was that, I believe it happened in this state, that the state police shot them all down. So it's dangerous when it happens.
Yeah.
I remember King's Poor People's Campaign, you know,
and yeah.
of course that ended more or less when he was shot. So it is dangerous when you get those coalitions going back to, what was it, Berkeley's Rebellion in Virginia in the 1700s.
You know, what I feel like rural, non-college educated Trump voters don't hear this discussion ever. There's no way for it to penetrate the sort of Fox News bubble, you know, like, I don't know how to communicate with people who might be open to that message. Any ideas?
I believe we have these conversations by reaching out to the individual and saying, you know, what are your goals? What do you want? And, you know, there are ways to get your kids educated without having to be a millionaire. And one of them happens to be you can change your government. You can pay taxes, or you can make the millionaires pay taxes, or whatever the scheme might be. But first, I think we have to stop the us and them. We on the progressive side, and that's where I place myself, we do the us and them as much as we feel others do it to us. So you have to reach out to see the individual with all of the individual's foibles, but also all of the wonderful things about that individual, and particularly, I think, reach out to talk about what is it that you want or what in your experience. I would suggest that people start with childhood stories. When you were a child, what was it that you wanted to do? What was it that you wanted to be? What stopped you from being it if you didn't achieve it? And then I think you understand that, hey, because people come from different places and look differently than you, they might not be that different in terms of their goals and their wants and their wishes.
Maybe this is a good place for you to read that section we were talking about in your book. So this is a conversation between Wayne Henson, who's Lonnie's dad, who's just come back from the war, and Bertrand Johnson. Wayne is white, Bertrand's black, and they're meeting, and they're both veterans.
On the evening that Wayne finished the application, he poured a bourbon and water for Bertrand and himself and opened ARC Cola for Lonnie. They sat in the everyday room around the table, and Wayne allowed Lonnie to pick up the neatly addressed envelope and examine it in the lamplight. And I should say, he's applied for a WPA school, and Bertrand has helped him to write the application. The envelope, yellow from age, had a stamp depicting the Marines raising a flag on Iwo Jima. It amazed Lonnie that the envelope was the promise of their future. "It's good as done," Bertrand assured Wayne. "They'll take you now, no doubt. They have to, according to Uncle Sam. And then you'll be set. You can go anywhere in the world with that skill, anywhere that they need electricity. And you'll be getting good pay and helping people all at the same time." Wayne admitted that he was nervous about it, but Bertrand waved him off. "Well, I'm not an educated man like you," Wayne said. "Where do you think I started from?" Bertrand asked. "A lot of it's just common sense and good luck. This young squire," he nodded to Lonnie, "he'll have the luck now. Once your daddy gets going a bit, then it's so much easier for the children to get a leg up in life. That's why I came back to Talmadge County. Well, because of my mother, but also to help the poor children whose parents don't have anything to help them. I figure I can teach them a little something, and at least what I've learned. Wayne sipped from the glass and sighed. This is a modern age now, Bertrand. You ought to be teaching all the children, not just the colored ones. That's good for you to say, Bertrand said slowly and looked down. How would you like that, Wayne said to Lonnie, to have Mr. Bertrand as your teacher? Lonnie gasped. His face burned. Maybe, he said softly, but the idea of the round-faced colored man as his teacher dumbfounded him. The other children would tease him if he knew a colored man taught him, and if they found out that his teacher was his father's friend, the teasing would doubtlessly turn to bullying. But then he thought it all akin to a fairy tale, something impossible, a fable for his father's imagination. Well, you needn't worry about it, Bertrand said and patted Lonnie's shoulder. I don't teach your grade anyway. They all laughed uncomfortably. Bertrand quickly finished his drink and announced that it was time for him to leave. But I am serious, Wayne said, and I want my son to know that I am. He was looking at Bertrand as he spoke. We have fought the most terrible war there ever has been. I hope it is the last war anybody will ever have to fight. And why shouldn't it be? Look here. White and colored together, we fought it, and so many people, they are saying millions of people died. He leaned forward and grasped Bertrand's arm. They're saying that maybe 10 million people died. But at the time they'd finished counting, I'll go crazy thinking about it. It's like somebody's taking a hammer to my head, and yet I was there, and you were there to see it. Yes, Bertrand said meekly. I saw the Jewish camps, one of them. So what are we going to do then? Are you keeping on in this old ways? He turned to Lonnie and pulled him close. No, son, we're fixing to change things. I ain't a fool to think that's going to happen overnight, but it's got to start somewhere. Thank you.
Anthony Grooms at the Kansas City Public Library, reading from his novel set in 1940s Georgia called The Vain Conversation. Published by the University of South Carolina Press, it was named an honor book by the Black Caucus of the American Library Association and was a finalist for Georgia's 2020 Townsend Prize for Fiction. Grooms was part of the Fall 2019 Writers at Work series On Writing, On Race with poet Damaris Hill. Her interview with Whitney Terrell is also in our audio archive under the New Letters on the Air tab on the website newletters.org, along with my 2003 conversation with Tony Grooms about his first award-winning novel set in Alabama, Bombingham. Broadcasting from UMKC since 1977, find out how you can help continue the literary tradition of New Letters on the Air by writing to radio at newletters.org. A production of New Letters Magazine, today's show was produced with interns Henry Shee, Anna Stokes, Evan Lohman, and Amina Dalton. Our assistant producer was Jamie Walsh. I'm Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air.